quiet, and then we can get going. Okay, I'd like to introduce our main speaker this evening from Marina Del Rey, Hank J.
Good evening, everyone. My name is Hank Johnson. I'm an alcoholic. I just want to welcome all you newcomers, those with less than 17 and a half years, to the meeting here tonight. And just a wonderful day here today. Up until now, it's been a really nice conference. And I used to drink a lot, and I walked into a bar when I was 18 years old and ordered a drink, and they served me. And, you know, here in California, you're supposed to be 21. They served me. I passed for 21. And immediately I became a man. That's what I wanted to be, a man. And a man can buy a drink over a bar without being asked. So I graduated right then and there. I never had to learn another thing for the rest of my life. What else is there to know if you can know how to order a drink? I could play the jukebox over in the corner just as good as the rest of the guys. In fact, I thought my selection of songs were a little better than most. And I could sit at the bar and look at myself in the mirror and get better looking after each drink. And I went back to that place every opportunity I had from then on. From then on, I drank on a steady basis. I had done a little behind the gym drinking before that, but this is big time, you know, when you can buy a drink over a bar. And so I just went back there all the time. You know, I hear people say when they came to AA, they just felt like they came home. You know, I never felt that way, folks. But I sure did at that bar. I just knew I belonged there. And I went back every opportunity I had from then on. And I met my wife in a bar. Where else do you meet girls? And we bought a little house in West Covina, a little suburb out of Los Angeles. Payments were $56 a month. That included interest and taxes and the whole shot. Nothing down, of course. And, you know, I had trouble making those payments. See, I used my money to drink with. And the payments had come due on the first of the month, and I thought, geez, how am I going to make this payment? And so I figured, well, I won't make it this month. I'll double up next month. Next month would come along, I'd have to come up with $112. My God, where am I going to get that? And I'd have to stiff some of my creditors, and somehow I'd make the payments. And, you know, we finally had to sell that place before they foreclosed out from under us. And we moved in with my father for free. And if anybody would have asked me, Hank, what is your problem? I would have said, money. Money's my problem. You know, she would just help out a little bit, go to work. How did I ever get involved in this kind of work that I'm doing? It just don't pay enough. And if anybody would have said, what is your problem? I would have said, money. You know, instead of her helping out, it turned out she was pregnant. She already had a baby by a previous marriage, and now she was pregnant. And hell, I didn't start saving for that baby until about a week before it was due. I couldn't come up with the money, so I went to the beneficial finance company. And I borrowed the money to pay the hospital and medical expenses. And, you know, when my son finally turned 25 and I finally got sober in AA, I finally got beneficial paid off. I don't know about you folks, but I always had a crisis in my life. I'd just about get those guys paid off and something would happen and I'd have to go consolidate my bills again. And they never gave me enough, really. I'd get, and besides, something would happen to part of that money on the way home, you know. And I'd get home and start paying off those bills. It wasn't enough. So I'd have to go to Pacific Finance and borrow the rest. And sometimes I had a bank loan going, too. Sometimes all three at the same time. And at the first of the year, it's great when you have all that interest to pay out. You know, you can deduct it off your income tax. But I used to wonder every year, you know, what the hell am I making these payments for? What am I buying with these payments? I'm just making payments, that's all. I'm not buying anything. And I finally discovered, after I had about 2 years of sobriety, I finally discovered what it was. I financed 30 years of drinking. Every time I took a drink, I paid an extra 10 or 15 cents in interest to Beneficial Finance. And my drunkalog is really a boring story. I hate to tell it because I'm ashamed. Had I known I was going to be the main speaker on Saturday night in San Jose, I would have tried to spice it up a little bit. But you hear such exciting things from this podium sometimes. Some of these guys have really done some drinking, I'll tell you. Jeez, their stories. Guy walked into a bar, he punched everybody out in the bar, and the cops came, and he punched the cops out too, and he gets thrown in jail, and he walks over to the bunk he wants and pulls a guy out of the bunk and punches him too. You know, now that's drinking. Gee, that is exciting drinking. Another guy I used to hear speak in AA used to hit telephone poles all the time, only they were 100 yards off the highway. And he used to go through tunnels 60 miles an hour and make a U-turn right in the middle of the tunnel. That is drinking. Another guy I heard of, this jet pilot, you know, he went on a 3-week binge, and he was in a blackout, operating in a blackout, and he woke up. He came out of his blackout going faster than the speed of sound at 10,000 feet. Now that's really drinking. All I ever did is just sat around and drank. I meant to do a lot of that stuff. I just never got around to it. I used to sit around and play old phonograph records. Watched quite a bit of TV. Sometimes I'd read a book. Nothing very exciting, just some condensed version in the Reader's Digest. And I just kind of watched the world go by. I didn't participate in it, I just watched it go by. And I criticized you for the way you lived your life. And I could do a hell of a lot better if I really wanted to. You can't blame a damn thing on me, I didn't do anything. You know, you hear... You know, my wife used to kick me out of the house a lot. You know, I never knew why. I didn't do anything. Just, you know. Then I finally got sober and I realized that's what it was. I never did anything. A lot of people in AA now have dual problems. You know, alcoholics and drug addicts and alcoholics and overeaters and alcoholics and this and alcoholics and that. I'm an alcoholic and a procrastinator. I always figure if a thing's worth doing, it's worth waiting until tomorrow to consider doing. And that's the way I live my life. Not very excited. I used to wake up, it'd be 10 o'clock in the morning, I'm already an hour late to work. Oh, geez, I'd throw my clothes on and get in that car and I'd weave in and out of traffic. I had to get there because, you see, I should have worked yesterday. I left all these papers all over my desk. I had papers in my desk drawer. Some of them were months old. They were too old to turn in. If I turned them in, I'd be fired for holding them so long. And if I didn't turn them in, I was going to get fired because I'd be discovered today. I knew it. I had that fear of impending doom that they talk about around here. And I knew by the time I got there, I was going to be fired. The boss would discover me and I'd get found out and that was it, you know. First thing I do is check my desk. Everything's the same as yesterday. Phew. Saved again. Go get a cup of coffee. Go back to my desk and shuffle papers and try to look interested and make excuses to my customers. They'd want to know where their stuff was. And I'd tell them, you know, you didn't get that in the mail? My God, you know, the class of help we hire nowadays, we just can't depend on them. They just don't know what the word service means. I'll personally take care of that myself today. You can count on that. And if you don't hear from me, you know, within the next couple of days, if you don't get something in the mail from me, why, call me again. Let's get this thing straightened up. or I'd use the computer excuse. That's a good one. You know, they're still using the computer excuse right to this day. You know, I'm one of the originators of the computer excuse. Computer's been down for the last 6 days. As soon as we get it working again, I'll get a printout and I'll call you and we'll get this thing straightened out right away. Yeah, I'm one of the originators of that excuse. Hell, I used that excuse before we even had a computer in our house. At a respectable time, I'd go next door to the bar that was conveniently located right next door to where I worked. And I'd go over there, and they sold martinis over there. And I like martinis. And they sold double martinis during the lunch hour for a dollar. You know, the regular ones were 75 cents. I figured, hell, you're going to have two martinis anyhow. Whoever heard of having one martini? You're going to have two anyway, so you might as well order the dollar one. You'll save 50 cents. God knows you need the money bad. And so I'd order the dollar one. And I'd get to comparing my drink against the guy sitting next to me. He'd have a 75 center. And I'd say to myself, who the hell do they think they're kidding around here? This isn't really a double. It's a little larger than the 75 center. That's all. Hell, I've been around. I know these things. So I better have another one. And then I'd have another one. And then I'd have another one. Then I'd have another one. And then I'd call the office and tell them, I forgot to tell you, I'm going on a lot of calls this afternoon. Take messages. I'll be back tomorrow morning at 9 o'clock. And I'd head towards the beach. By then, I'd been kicked out of my house for the umpteenth time and divorced for the third time by the same wife. And I got this little garage place that I was living in. They converted this garage into some living quarters. And actually what I had was a 12 by 15 room. And I bought a turntable and 10 speakers from a friend of mine. And I had speakers in all four corners, behind the drapes, behind the couch, in the bathroom, in the kitchen. You name it, I had a speaker there. And so I'd stop on the way to the beach, to my place, I'd stop and buy the cheapest bottle of vodka I could find. You know, whatever was on sale that day at Thrifty's, you know, in that dusty basket they've got, the stuff they want to get rid of, you know, and mark it down. And that's what I would buy. And I'd get home about 2 or 2:30 in the afternoon, and I'm kind of a neat drunk. I'd hang up my clothes real carefully so the creases fall properly, you know. And I'd put my shirt away and my tie and socks and shoes, and I'd put my pajamas on. And I'd sit on the edge of the bed, and I'd untap this cheap vodka, and I'd take a big, big jolt out of it, you know, several swallows. And I'd say to myself, well, done it again today. This cannot continue. You know, you're not the only guy that's ever been divorced. You're not the only guy that's ever been in debt. Why the hell don't you do something about it? All you do is sit around and talk about stuff. You never take any action on anything. And then I'd put one of these old phonograph records on the turntable, one of these old 78s, you know, something like Billy Eckstein singing, Who Can I Turn To? And then I'd start talking to myself. Giving myself a real good bawling out. You can't do anything about your marriage, but at least you could get a second job and you could get squared away financially anyhow. Wait a minute, you don't need to get a second job. You're in sales, I'd say to myself. If you're in sales, you can make any amount of money you want to, within reason, of course. By God, that's right, I'd say to myself. And starting tomorrow morning, it's all going to be different. Starting tomorrow morning, I'm going to get up at 6 o'clock. I'm going to get down to that damn office by 7. I'm going to knock out paperwork for a couple hours. And when that phone starts ringing tomorrow, I'm going to be ready to do business. And starting tomorrow, it's a whole new life. Every waking hour, I'm going to work, work, work. Sell, sell, sell. I'm going to just earn all this money. And you know, it's just, I'm not even going to drink for the rest of this year. I'm just, you know, I can devote 1 year out of my life to getting squared away and earning money. A lot of people do stuff like that. They take jobs in Saudi Arabia and work in the oil fields and stuff like that. I don't have to leave town. Hell, I got character. I can do this. You know. And starting tomorrow, it's work, 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 sell, sell, sell. I'll I'll go in the office on Saturday and clean up my paperwork. And hell, I got a key to the office. I can go in there on Sunday and plan my work for the coming week. And you know, if you're in sales, if you plan your work and then work your plan, you just can't miss. And God, I don't know about you people, but when I make those wonderful decisions like that, that's the solution to my problems. When I know it, so I've got cause to celebrate, so I have another drink. And then I have another one, and another one, and another one. And then I try to figure out what I'm going to do with all the money that's coming in. You know, if I triple my income, I'll be out of debt in no time. What are you going to do with all the money then? You know, well, I'm going to buy a white Lincoln Continental, for one thing. And I'm going to drive it up to that house where she still lives. And on the way up there, I'll stop at the Hallmark card shop. And I'll buy the really beautiful card, at least a dollar card, you know, no 25 cents, you know, something with a lot of sentimental poetry on it, a sticky kind. And then over on the left-hand side, all right, thanks for all the good years, H. Yeah. Not Henry, not Hank, just H. That's class. I don't know if you know class up here. And I'll get a gold-plated key, and I'll put it in the envelope with the car. And I'll drive that car up to that house where she still lives. And I'll hang a U-turn, and I'll coast in, you know, right in front of the house and be real quiet. And just park that car right in front of the house. Then I'll tiptoe up on the steps, and I'll put that card with the key down the mail chute. And then I'll split. And the next morning, she'll get up and she'll go through her routine. And then she'll get her mail. And naturally, she'll open that big envelope first. And she'll open the key, will drop out. I wonder what that key is, she'll say. And she'll read the poetry on the card. It'll just be excruciatingly painful for her to read. Tears will just roll down her cheeks. It'll, you know. Then she'll look over on the left-hand side and see, thanks for all the good years, H. And then she'll think about it for a minute or two. Then she'll look at that key and she'll wonder what the key's for. And somehow she'll look out in the front and she'll see that white Lincoln Continental out there, brand new, shiny, gorgeous car. And she'll put it all together that that's her automobile. Then she won't think I'm so bad. Then she'll be sorry, by God. And I don't know about you people, but I just get a lift when I give those expensive gifts like that. So I have another drink. And then I look up at the clock and it's 10:45. 10:45? It can't be that late. I just sat down on the edge of this bed, you know. It can't be that late. And I'd call the operator and check the time. Yep, 10:45, my God. And then I realize I'm almost out of booze. So I'd throw my clothes on over my pajamas and run 2 blocks to the liquor store. I had to get there before 11. That's when I first started jogging about that time. I'd get there just before they were closing up, you know, and bottle of Smirnoff's. I always bought the better brands there and right around where I lived. I wouldn't want them to think I was cheap right there in the neighborhood. And I could walk back to my shack with peace and contentment and security for the rest of the night. And I'd get back and play a few more of those old 78 records and fantasize a little more. And I went all over the world just sitting on the edge of my bed. And, you know, maybe I'll buy a boat too, you know. I'll buy a little Mercedes coupe for myself. And I had all these dreams, and I traveled all over, and it was just wonderful. And then I started rehearsing the speech I was going to have to give at the banquet, because I knew I was going to be Salesman of the Year. And somewhere in there, I'd pass out. I'd wake up the next morning, it'd be 10 o'clock. Maury and I are late to work. Jeez, I'd throw my clothes on real fast and weave in and out of traffic. I had to get there because I should have worked yesterday. I left all these papers all over my desk, and the papers in my desk drawer, some of them were months old, and God, the boss was fine. I knew I'd be fired, and it was all going to happen today. I knew it, and I'd get there and check my desk out. Everything was the same as yesterday. Whew, saved again. I'd go get a cup of coffee, come back to my desk, and shuffle papers and try to look interested, make excuses to my customers, and at a respectable time, I'd go to the bar that was conveniently located right next door to where I worked. And I'd go over there and make my big decision of the day, whether to have the dollar one or the 75 cent. And then I'd have another one, then I'd have another one, then I'd have another one. And then I'd call the office. Going on a lot of calls this afternoon, take messages. I'll be back tomorrow morning at 9 o'clock. Hell, I could have just called. I could have hollered it over there, but I always had a lot of class. I always phoned them, you know. And then I'd head for the beach, and I'd stop and buy the cheapest bottle of vodka I could find, and get home by 2 or 2:30 and hang up my clothes and put my pajamas on and sit on the edge of the bed, untap this cheap vodka, and I'd take a big, big jolt out of it. And I'd say to myself, you've done it again today. This cannot continue. You know, you're not the only guy that's ever been divorced. You're not the only guy that's ever been in debt. Why the hell don't you do something about it? All you do is sit around and talk about stuff. You never take any action on anything. And I'd put one of those old 78 records on. Something like Billy Eckstein singing, "Who Can I Turn To?" And then I'd have another one, then I'd have another. And then I'd start talking to myself about getting a second job and all this stuff and buying white Lincoln Continentals. And, you know, I didn't do that once or twice. You know, I did that hundreds of times. Hundreds of times. And then towards the end of the month, the boss would want to know, you know, "Are you in sales here?" And I'd say, "Yeah, I'm in sales." "Well, how about making a sale?" "Don't worry about a thing. I'm a fast finisher," I'd tell him. And I was, because he'd scare me. I was afraid I'd lose my jobs. I'd work around the clock. And I always made my quota in this company. I always made my quota. And for 8 drunken years in a row, they gave me a plaque with my name on it for outstanding salesmanship and product knowledge and being the type of representative we want to represent this company. All that good stuff, you know, for 8 drunken years in a row. And then I got sober. I didn't win a plaque for 8 years. I lost my motivation. See, fear motivated me back then. And I can really work. If you put the pressure on me, God, I'm a worker. Tell me. But I lost my motivation after I got sober. You know, what they talk about God around here. God's going to take care of you. When you get sober, just turn it over to God, you know. I thought that meant he was going to sell insurance for me, too. But after 2 years of sobriety, I walked in there and the guy fired me. And I said, "Fired? You got to be kidding. I got an outstanding record with this company." And he said, "Not lately, you don't." And I said, "Well, I'm not going to allow you to fire me without speaking to the regional manager." And I went to see the regional manager. And I used to say that I went to see and talk with him. Actually, what I did is I went to see him and I sniveled and cried to him. You know? I told him, you know, what they want to do down there at the branch office? They want to fire me. Can you believe that? Me, with my outstanding sales record. And they want to fire me. And I said, "You know, what they don't know is that about 2 years ago, I completely changed my life. I quit drinking. Trying to make it with my wife again. And the kids. Trying to pay my bills on time and become a citizen in the community again, you know, and help poor, unfortunate people that suffer from a seemingly hopeless disease recover, you know. And now they want to fire me." And this regional manager said, "Gee, Hank, I had no idea you had a problem with alcohol. Gee, I sure hope everything works out for you and your wife and everything, you know." He says, "But I can't do anything about your work. If they don't want you to work in that office, I can't make them keep you. But if you claim to be a salesman, I'll tell you what I'll do. I'll put you on paid leave of absence for a very short period of time. Claim to be a salesman, go sell yourself to another branch office." And that's what I did.
And I just completed 25 years with that company and told them what to do with their time. I hung in there. What happens to me is what happened to me happens to a lot of people in AA. You know, I see it happen all the time. It happens at various lengths of sobriety. Some of us just get so spiritual that we just sail off into the blue. Sure, I got fired. I should have been fired. Hell, I spent about 95% of my day calling other members of Alcoholics Anonymous instead of working. You know, I might not be sober today if I wouldn't have done it that way, but it's still, I deserve to be fired. And I was spiritual. I was kind of a cut above the rest of you poor guys in AA. And I didn't have to do the everyday mundane things that you people seem to have to do. And so the guy fired me. And then finally, my sponsor finally got to me, and he said, you know, Hank, some of us just get so heavenly, we just become of no earthly good to anybody. And he pointed out that in the book, Alcoholics Anonymous, it states in there that it's okay to have your head in the clouds, but you should keep your feet firmly planted on the ground. That's where your fellows are, and that's where the work is to be done. And that's what I've tried to do ever since. I stayed with that company. I transferred to another office. Before all that happened, I got a call one night from my ex-wife, and she called and said, come and get your drunken son. He's just like you are. And seeing he had turned 16, and he was getting in a lot of trouble in school, nothing major, just a lot of nickel and dime stuff, you know. But it was driving her crazy. He went to a party one night and came home drunk and threw up on the carpet or whatever it was. And it was the last straw. She called me and said, come and get him. He's just like you are. You know, back then I had no self-worth at all. I should have said to her, wait a minute, you know, you want him in a divorce, you keep him. I don't want him. You know, if you're having trouble with him, well, deal with it, you know. But I had no self-worth back then. You know, she said, come and get him, and I went and got him. He didn't want to come and live with me. I didn't want him to come and live with me. But she said, so we had to do it, right? he used to come and visit me once in a while back then, before that happened. Every once in a while, he'd come for a weekend. I never knew what the hell to say to him. What do you say to a 16-year-old kid? I could never think of anything. You know, I figured, well, if I was a real dad, what would I be saying to him? So I'd criticize him on his grades. How come you're not playing football as big as you are? You should be student body president. You know, all the things I kind of wish I would have done when I was in school. He'd just shrug it off, you know. But if I was drinking, which was most of the time, I just tended to slobber all over him. Tell him how much I loved him. All the trouble your mother and I have had all through these years has nothing to do with you. We love you. And he'd just sit there and cringe. And I'd get him cornered so he couldn't leave, you know. You know how that is. When you start talking like that, you can't stop, or at least I can't. And I would tell him all kinds of stuff, you know, how much I loved him, how he was a love child, he was no accident, we planned to have you, and all these things. And he just looked at me, God, I can still remember that look on his face. And somehow he would escape. The next morning I'd wake up, I'd just be ashamed of myself. Not that I had been drunk the night before, but that I had let my guard down and told my son I loved him. You see, I'm from the old school. You don't show anybody any kind of emotion ever. I used to go to these jazz joints and hear all these musicians, you know, world-famous musicians blowing trumpets and saxophones and stuff, and just really great, you know. And I'd sit there with a cigarette in one hand and a drink in another and never move a muscle. And all these squares were snapping their fingers and tapping their toes, you know, and I'd look down on them. Squares, that's what they were, you know. If you look real close, you could see they were wearing white socks, probably, with their dark blue suit. And so that's the way I was, you know, I practiced that all my life. Never show anybody how you feel. You never laugh at a joke or show any kind of emotion. So when I woke up in the morning, I just ashamed of myself. I couldn't look at my son in the eye. Couldn't look at him. And so I'd get him in the car and drive him home and dump him off. Just ashamed. And, you know, so he had to come and live with me. He didn't want to, but he had to. You know, one of those times that he went home after visiting me one weekend, he asked his mother, he says, you've divorced him. Is there any kind of legal action I can take? So anyhow, he came in and moved in, and that was the start of a beautiful relationship that we've got going to this day. And it wasn't very much longer, she moved in too. And she told me, I won't fight you on your drinking anymore. In fact, I'll join you. You know. And I thought, I should have thought right then. I just let that one go over my head. I never even thought about it, because all the years I was married to her, she never drank. And she was always afraid to drink. She always knew she was an alcoholic. Before she even took her first drink, she knew she was an alcoholic. You know, because her personality was quite a bit like her father's. And her father was a real nice guy, a real personable guy, and everybody liked him. But, geez, when he took a drink, all hell broke loose. And he'd go out on binges, and he'd be gone for several days, and he'd end up in a hospital or in jail or something. And they couldn't believe it about him. And she was always afraid that she would be that way, too. And she was right. She was a terrible drinker. She was just not a fun person to be around when she drank. And I'm not here to tell you her, you know, to take her inventory or anything, but I'm just going to tell you a few of the things that she did. It'll help you understand me and my problem a little bit. She did stuff like throw the Christmas tree, lights and all, out the back door. She'd break my old 78 records just because I played them more than once. You know? And I'm playing the same music since I was 18 years old, and here I was in my 40s, you know, or close to it, and I was still playing the same damn records. And I'd play one of these records, and, you know, I hadn't heard it for a while. Really, God, it's a good song. You know, play it one more time, you know. Terrific. Geez, where's that record been? I haven't heard that. Then sometimes I just get hung up on a trumpet toot, you know. I'd lay that needle in there. Toot, oh, man. Lay it in there again. That used to drive her crazy. She'd walk over to the phonograph and take the record. Bang! Geez, don't break those. Those are collector's items. You can't buy those. And good, I'll never have to hear that again. Yeah, it was just chaos around that house. Yeah. And, you know, she used to claim she was born an alcoholic. You know, I think in my case, I drank myself into alcoholism. I drank, you know, alcohol did what it was supposed to do for me. It was a social lubricant. It enabled me to converse with people and to be social and to dance and romance and all these things, you know, and it did the job and it did it well. And then all of a sudden that stuff turned on me. I'm not sure when it did, but I became allergic to it. And the same thing happened to me with penicillin. I took penicillin several times and it did the job it was supposed to do. Last time I took penicillin, I wound up in the hospital for 8 days. I damn near died. And the doctor said, hey, you know, you shouldn't have taken that penicillin. Well, hell, it's always worked before, I told him. It's always did the job it was supposed to do. Well, don't ever take it again. You're allergic to the stuff. Next time you take it, you might die. Really? No kidding. Okay. I sure as hell won't take it again, I promise. And, you know, I've kept that promise. I haven't had a shot of penicillin for about 35 years. I haven't had to join any kind of an organization or anything. I haven't had to get a sponsor. I never find it necessary to call anybody at 2 o'clock in the morning. I got this uncontrollable desire to have a shot of penicillin. I just quit cold turkey, and I've never. But I think, you know, it's kind of a similar thing. I became allergic to alcohol and didn't know it, however. And it turns out it's a little bit different. The allergy is a little different. But anyway, you know, I finally told her, I said, Jesus, you know, this isn't working out any better than it worked out before. And you know, I always let you kick me out of those other houses, but I moved here first. Therefore, you go this time. And so I went to my brother's house that night, to my good brother's house, and the one that you can knock on his door at 1 or 2 o'clock in the morning, as long as you got something in a brown paper bag, he'll pull you right in. And we sat up all night and drank and philosophized and all that stuff, and it seemed like his wife didn't understand his problem either. And we both picked a couple of losers. And while I was gone, she decided to commit suicide. But which was no big deal. She was always, that's how she solved her problems, you know. And she'd commit suicide. And even into AA, she was suicidal. She had about 8 months on the program, and something bad happened one day. And so she figured, well, I'll commit suicide. You know, that's how you solve your problems, right? And so it was something really important. I don't know what it was for sure, but then she decided, well, she couldn't do it because she was the cookie lady at the meeting that night. You wonder how come they give some of us flaky people some of these jobs that we get, you know? Well, they're life-saving jobs. That's right. At least they'll keep you sober anyhow, or help to. And so anyhow, that night before she did it, boy, this is all in a blackout. She don't remember any of this stuff. You know, I never did remember anything after she took the first drink. But that night she went into the, gonna commit suicide, but before she did, she went into the closet where my clothes were hanging and just took a knife and slashed every stitch of clothes I owned, just ripped everything to pieces, cut my ties in half and my shirts, and even stabbed my damn shoes, just made a complete shambles out of everything. And she took the rags that she had made and put them around the doors and the windows and tried to make the place airtight. She turned the gas on the kitchen oven and went to bed. Woke up the next morning and nothing happened. And she looked around. She couldn't believe what she had done. She was the only one that was there that night, and she could not believe what she had done. And then I came home. I had trouble believing it myself. Then our son came home, and he thought we were moving again. That's another thing. We used to move quite a bit, too. I don't know if anybody identifies with that or not, but we used to move quite often. And there we were. We had hit bottom. I'm from a good family. She was from a good family. When we got married, we had all kinds of great plans. We were going to live the great American dream, you know. We were going to live the good life. And all we had managed to do was just sit around and drink every bit of goodness out of our lives. And from then on, it was no good. From then on, you know, our actions didn't change all that much, but it was just lousy from then on. And it wasn't all that good before that, but God, it was bad after that. And we had hit bottom. You know, I had hit bottom, only I didn't know it, so I just drank right through that bottom. Because this is the time where guys you hear talk, and they'll say, I hit bottom, so then I called AA. And some real nice guy came out and took me to a meeting, and everything's just been wonderful ever since. You know? Not me. I didn't know enough. I just drank. And I don't know how many moments of truth I had. You know, you hear these guys, I had a moment of truth, so I called AA. And some guy came out and talked to me and took me to an AA meeting. It's just been wonderful ever since. Hell, I don't know how many moments of truth I've had. Hell, I can't stand the truth. You know, every time I hear the truth, especially about myself, I got to have a drink and fast immediately. I can't face the truth. And so I don't identify with those guys. And so it just went on. And but a little bit before that, we had started back to group therapy. You know, we were in and out of group therapy and private sessions for a long time. And this therapist asked me one time, "Do you really drink as much as she says?" I said, "Hell yes, I do. I drink a lot. Who wouldn't? Married to a woman like that. I got two of the worst children you could possibly imagine on this pressure job. My God, the pressure on that job alone would make you drink. But what the hell is the big deal? I just don't understand the big deal. And so I drink. So what? They've never missed a meal. But they've always had a decent place to live. You know, they've always had bicycles and whatever it is that they wanted. They've always had it before I drank. I always saw to it that they had that. So I drank. So what?" And he said, "Have you ever thought of quitting?" I said, "As a matter of fact, I have. And I did. I thought about it every night. You know, I'm not going to drink, not tonight, but starting tomorrow morning at 6 o'clock. And he said, "Have you ever thought of going to AA? AA? Jeez, you know, thanks but no thanks. I've already been to AA. And I had gone to a meeting one time. And I don't know how the hell I ever got there, but I was there. And it was one of these meetings where they give chips for various lengths of sobriety. And the leader that day said, "Has anyone just finished their first 30 days of sobriety? If so, come up and get a chip." And here comes this guy up, you know. "My name's Joe Blow, and I'm an alcoholic, and I know this is a spiritual program that I found God when I walked through the doors of AA, and it's the lights in the eyes of the people that just turn me on and keep me coming back to these meetings, and I just love every single person here. And just before I came to the meeting tonight, I got a call from my employer, and he's made me general manager down at the plant. Just a glorious way of life, and I just love coming to these meetings. It's been the best 30 days of my entire life. And for all you newcomers, keep coming back. We love you." And I thought, oh my God. "Anybody else?" Comes this lady. "My name is Mary Smith, and I'm an alcoholic, and I'm proud to get this chip, and I know this is a spiritual program that I found God when I walked through the doors of AA. And it's the lights in the eyes of the people that just turn me and keep coming back these days. And I just love every single person here. You know, hate is no longer a word in my vocabulary. I just love everybody. Not just the members of AA, but everybody in the whole world." He said, "A short time ago, my children were failing in school. Now we're getting letters from all the major universities offering scholarships. I wake up in the morning, and I reach over and I grab the hand of God, and we walk through the day hand in hand. What a glorious way of life this is. And just think, I'm just starting this great adventure. For all you newcomers, keep coming back. We love you." And I thought, oh, jeez. I never went back, I'll tell you that. And the therapist said, "You know, you ever thought of going to AA?" I said, "Forget it. I've already been to AA. Some kind of a religious cult of some kind. It's okay for them, but I'm just not interested in it. You know? And but I've heard about some stuff called an abuse. I read an article on it, and I think I'll get some of that, because I'm going to quit just to prove once and for all that alcohol isn't the problem in this marriage. And I was right, of course. It was a symptom. so he put me in touch with this doctor. And the doctor's receptionist says, "Well, you can have an appointment a week from next Tuesday," or whenever it was. And she said, "Whatever you do, don't drink for at least 48 hours prior to coming on the appointment if you want an abuse. Because, you know, if you have alcohol in your system and you take an abuse or you pour alcohol on top of it, you can get deathly ill. So be sure not to drink for at least 48 hours. And I didn't. And I went there on my appointment. And the doctor checked my heart and blood pressure, and he called me into his office and sat me down. And he started talking about the disease of alcoholism. Well, I didn't want to hear that crap, you know. But he says, you know, if what you say is true, you haven't had a drink for 48 hours prior to coming here. You know, you're over the hump. You never need to take another drink for as long as you live. Jesus scared the hell out of me. I wanted to quit, but I wasn't quite prepared to quit that long at that time. And he said, you know, you don't need abuse. If you haven't had a drink for 48 hours and you were able to not drink for 48 hours, you don't need abuse. And he said, so he says, what I recommend that you do, he says, is not take. And I'm a crazy doctor. And he started talking to me about alcoholism and how people with the disease of alcoholism have character defects. And they refuse to cope with their problems. Instead of coping tonight, they get drunk instead. And they wake up the next morning and they still got all their problems, only now they got a hangover on top of it. And they repeat this over and over. And they just keep doing it over and over. And he was telling me my story, but I didn't recognize it. And he just went on and on and on about it. And I finally said, well, if you're not going to give me abuse, then I guess I better go. How much do I owe you? And he said, I can see I'm not making much of an impression on you, so I'm going to tell you something I wouldn't normally tell my regular patients, but due to the nature of your appointment here today, he said, I assume you have trouble with alcohol or you wouldn't be asking for abuse, so I'm going to tell you something. I happen to know a little bit about it. You see, my wife's an alcoholic. And we've tried all these things. We've tried abuse and rest homes and sanitariums and all the things they talk about in chapter 3. You know, he recited all those things. And he says nothing's worked for her. But she's sober now. She goes to AA. And that's what I recommend that you do. And promise me when you leave here, you'll drive up to the Manhattan Beach Clubhouse and buy the book Alcoholics Anonymous. And there'll be no charge for this call. That's the only thing that guy said that day that impressed me at all. So I went up and bought the book and threw it on the dresser, and then this fiasco happened with my wife. And she had been with me, and she had heard what the doctor had said. So she went back and asked the doctor if he thought she was an alcoholic. And he said he didn't know, but why didn't she go to some meetings with his wife? So she came home that night. She said, I'm going to go to AA with the doctor's wife. And be careful, I said. Be careful. You know, just remember the name of that organization is Alcoholics Anonymous. That means no names. Don't give them my name, whatever you do. I don't want anybody knocking on my door trying to convert me. So off she went. She went with the doctor's wife to the meetings. And the very first thing they told her in AA, the very first thing they told her was that it wasn't her fault that I drank. You know, they could have started her off with something entirely different than that. I just about had her convinced that it was all her fault that I drank. They said, no, if you're carrying that kind of guilt around with you, you're only kidding yourself. You can't make anybody drink. Don't take the blame for his drinking. You know, he would have drank anyhow, whether he'd ever met you or not. So don't take that blame. You're just kidding yourself. And you can't make him quit either. We don't have that kind of power that we can make anybody quit drinking. So don't pour his booze down the sink. He'll just go buy another bottle. If you feel you have a problem with alcohol, that you're an alcoholic, maybe you better come back to these meetings and work on your problem and just let that SOB drink himself to death. If that's what he wants to do, it's his life. She kind of liked the ring of that. So she went to meetings, and to be a good guy, every once in a while I'd go to a meeting with her. I hated the meetings. You know, I just hated them. Especially holding hands afterwards and saying the Lord's Prayer. There was just something hokey about that to me. It just seemed like those same two people were at every meeting I went to. And you can't, you know, once the meeting is over, you can't get out of the place. There's another meeting that starts immediately after the meeting, and these ladies would start coming towards me. And I could see them coming. It just seemed like the closer they got, the longer their fingernails became. And the little fangs, little miniature vampires were just descending on me. And they were looking for new blood. And they'd say to me, you know, they'd ask me, are you Lou's husband? And I'd say, yeah, I'm Lou's husband. Well, are you an alcoholic too? And I'd say, no, I'm not an alcoholic too. I'm a visitor. And she's one. Work on her. She needs. And so I finally made up my mind. I've gone to my last meeting. I can't stand it. So I told her, I said, I've gone to my last meeting, but, you know, I'm going to quit drinking. And I went to I don't know how many meetings I went to, a lot of meetings. And I deliberately did not listen, just like someone else talked about. I deliberately did not listen to the, you know, I shut it down, I shut off everybody, everything that was said to me. And somehow I still got the damn message. I knew I was an alcoholic, but I couldn't stand the meetings. So I told her, I said, I'm going to quit drinking, but I've gone to my last meeting. So I did. I quit drinking a little bit before Thanksgiving. And I didn't drink through the drinkingest part of the year, through the Christmas holidays. And the Saturday night after Christmas came, and she went off to a meeting, and I stayed home. And I kind of took a little mini inventory of the situation. You know, I said to myself, you know, if you haven't drank since before Thanksgiving and you didn't drink through the drinking as part of the year, that proves that you were wrong. You're not really an alcoholic after all. So I went and bought a half pint of vodka. I no sooner got it back to the place and I drank it. What the hell did I buy a half pint for? I went and bought a fifth. Went and bought another fifth. And I drank all Saturday night and all day Sunday, and I closed some bar up somewhere at 2 a.m. And I woke up, it was 10 o'clock, and I'm already an hour late to work. And you know, you've got to show up on Monday or you're an alcoholic. And especially after a holiday, my God, if you don't show up, then that proves you're an alcoholic. And so I got there. I was late, but I got there. And I went over to that bar a little early that day because I was sick. You know, I hadn't drank for a little over 30 days, and I was really sick. And I poured all that alcohol into my system all at once. So I went over to the bar a little early, and I ordered a Bloody Mary, because that's what you order when you're sick. It's not really a social drink of any kind. It's just, you know, it's medicine, that's all. I ordered a glass of medicine. The guy got a big tall glass. He put shaved ice in it and put a shot of vodka, and he put tomato juice and Tabasco and Worcestershire sauce and salt, and he squeezed a lime. I thought he'd never get that thing. Man, you know. And I took that glass and I drank it straight down. Man, it hit bottom and it put out that fire, you know. And, oh, jeez. You know, make me another one. I spilled half of it all over my tie. I went to the restroom and I told him, make another one. And I went in there and cleaned the tomato juice off my tie. Came back out, he says, did you want another Bloody Mary or did you want a martini? And I said, I'll just skip it. I went over to the coffee shop section at this bar and I had a sandwich and a glass of milk, and I haven't had a drink since. And that's been a little over in 2 days it'll be 17 and a half years. But who's counting, right? I have often thought, had I known that was going to be my last drink, I sure as hell wouldn't have had a Bloody Mary. Could have had something in a fancy glass. Drank it straight down like 50-year-old brandy or something. You know, really good, something really good. And drank it straight down. Then I could have smashed the glass on the floor and stomped out of the bar, triumphant over alcohol. But I didn't know it. 2 or 3 weeks went by, you know. and I wasn't aware. I was in some kind of never-never land, you know. I just I found myself at AA meetings of all places. And then I realized, and, you know, I kind of came to my senses a little bit. I realized I hadn't had a drink in 2 or 3 weeks. And then anger set in. I had just completed 30 years of drinking. And I had this rotten wife and 2 of the worst children you could possibly imagine. And this pressure job. And I owe money to everybody. And it's all past due. And that phone rings. I jump clear across the room. And someone knocks on the door. I know it's the sheriff. I don't know what I've done, but I know I'm guilty. I'm ready to go. Yeah. And now I can't even drink. Now they've taken that away from me, too. What the hell am I going to do with the rest of my life? Nothing. That's what I'm going to do. Nothing. There's nothing to do if you don't drink. I don't care what they say in AA, how wonderful it is. You know, they're, you know, they haven't drank the stuff I've been drinking, I'll tell you that. And I'm stuck. You know, my life is over. I might as well dig a hole and cover me up. It's gone. Everything is gone. It's one long, great tunnel from here on out. I'll get up in the morning and make it to work on time, and then I'll come home on time, and then I'll have dinner on time, and I'll go to a meeting on time, and come back home and go to bed on time, and then I'll get up and, you know, and just, oh, it's just a never-ending, you know, thing, and I'm stuck. Never able to go to a decent restaurant ever again. I'm going to be stuck at Denny's for the rest of my life. What do they want to know when you go into a nice restaurant? What's the first thing they want to know? Would you like a cocktail before dinner? And you can't say to them, well, yeah, I'd like one, but you see, I've got this disease. It's an allergy of the body coupled with an obsession of the mind. If I even take one drink, I can't predict my behavior. If it wasn't for that, I'd sure have one, I'll tell you that. You know, I used to think you had to explain all that stuff to people. I used to spend a lot of my day back then explaining things to people that they never wanted, that didn't want to hear it. The hell, if I was standing on the street corner and somebody walked up, I'd start explaining what I was doing there. I had no self-worth. I even had to explain what little bit of space I was taking up in this world. And that's one of the things I'm working on now, not to explain so much. Every once in a while, I'll catch myself explaining some long, involved thing, you know, and I'll just catch myself, and I'll stop right in mid-explanation. You know, they never notice the difference. It turns out no one wants to hear those explanations. No one's interested in your excuses. They, you know, they don't want to know why you haven't done something you were supposed to do. You know, what they're interested in is what you've done lately. And for some reason, you never get to tell that. The word always gets out real fast on that when you do something. And so I'm trying to quit explaining altogether. Everything I knew for sure turned out to be all wrong. Hell, I went into a nice restaurant just recently. And they asked me, would you like a cocktail before dinner? No, thanks. Didn't even phase her. That was another worry I had. What are they going to say when they find out that I don't drink anymore? That was a reservation I had about joining this outfit. You know, what are they going to say when they find out that I don't drink? You know? I'm here to tell you, they don't really care out there whether you drink or not. That's what hurts so much, you know, if they had any feeling about it one way or the other, you know, but they just don't give a damn. One, you know, indifference they have about whether you drink or not. And so she, you know, when I told her no the other night, she just said okay and went over to the next table and asked them, and they did. I always check, and they're always drinking. I'm the only guy in the whole place not drinking. That's okay. I've had my share, you know. But the sick part of this whole story is that every once in a while I look over there, and there'll be a nicely dressed couple, and they're celebrating an anniversary or something. And they'll have martinis, and they'll be clicking their glass. And every once in a while, after 17 and a half years of sobriety, every once in a while, that looks good to me. So you're not dealing with a well man here tonight, I'll tell you that. I still have the disease of alcoholism, that's for damn sure. Hell, you can see them when they're clicking those glasses. You can see a little bead, you know, melting down the side of the glass. And you can see the olive right in the glass. If you look close, you can see the pimento in the olive in the glass. Well, who's looking, right? And sometimes that looks good. So, geez, I got to call my sponsor all the time. I got to read the big book. I've got to go to meetings. And I've got to talk in San Jose. This is a pleasure to talk here. But the guy over here, he can tell you some of the places we've spoke. You know, that's another thing that every time I hear somebody say, you know, there's no such thing as a bad meeting. Well, they haven't been to some of the meetings I've been to. I really like the Saturday Night Live group. If I lived up here, I'd be going to this meeting. You know, you guys have got enthusiasm. You know, I've been over at that meeting. It's a terrific meeting. But some of these meetings, you know, and that's okay. Some people like those other meetings, and that's the reason they've got so many different kinds of meetings. And so you find meetings that you're comfortable in. And I didn't know that then, back then. But I've got to call my sponsor all the time. I've got to go to meetings. I've got to speak when I'm asked to. I've got to do other things that I'm asked to do. Because, you see, I want to maintain my sobriety. I'll do anything to maintain my sobriety. Because, you see, now I never want to drink again. It doesn't scare me to think that thought anymore. I just hope that I'll never, ever have to drink again as long as I live. And I'm also very glad that when I was new that I got a sponsor. Because it's very important for people like me to get a sponsor. And I'm glad I got a tough sponsor. Because when you get a good sponsor, a good sponsor will insist that you work the 12 steps. A good sponsor will help you maintain your sobriety while you're working them. A good sponsor will answer all those stupid questions that you've been saving up. To ask somebody, but we're ashamed to ask. And stuff that you should have learned while you were in grammar school or junior high school, that you went to the bathroom when they were passing out that information or something, you know. And you can ask your sponsor those, and they don't laugh too hard at you when you ask. So I'm glad I got a sponsor. Because, you see, it helped me, by having a sponsor, it helped me work the steps. And that's what I'm really glad about. Because, you see, I need the 12 steps to replace what I gave up. Because, you know, son, you're asked to cope with a lot of stuff around here. Sometimes things really happen. Bad news happens in AA, you know. And they ask you to cope with this stuff without drinking. Without smoking any of those funny cigarettes, you know, without taking any pills, prescription or otherwise, you know. And they just expect you to cope with all this stuff, and so you need something. And that's what the 12 steps are designed for me anyway. And so I'm very glad that I took them, because you never know when the chips are going to come down. And the chips came down about 6.5 years ago for me. My wife got cancer, and through 5 years, and she passed away, you know. But the last year, I'm not going to tell you a long cancer story. I hate them, but the last year she didn't even know me. But you see, this point that I'm making here is not to get sympathy from you, but to tell you that I didn't have to drink when the chips were down. And she didn't either, by the way. And by now I was dependable. And I was able to give her some comfort when she was sick. And I was still employed, so I had good group insurance. And if I'd have had $5 million, she wouldn't have had any better medical care. And when she passed away, she didn't even know me. And, you know, it was a blessing that she went when she did. But I don't have any guilty feelings about it, which is really marvelous, it's a miracle. Because, you see, our house was in order. And that's what they talk about in AA quite a bit. They read the vision for you and they talk about house being in order. And our house was in order. And we had said all the things that we were supposed to say. Everything that needed to be said had been said long before. And so when she passed away, I don't have any guilt feelings. I don't have to say to myself, geez, if only I would have done this. If only I would have done that. Yeah, I don't have those feelings. It's a shame that she had to go, but she did. And I can mope around and mourn if I want to, but I've mourned long enough. Or I can choose to live. And that's what I've chosen. I've chose to live. And I've completely changed my life again. I sold that house up in the desert. We lived up in the desert for a long time. And I bought myself a boat. And I've got it in a slip in Marina Del Rey, and I'm living on the boat. Now, if somebody will just help me start that damn thing, I'm going to become a sea captain. Something I always fantasized about. And I've really got a good life going today. And I love being single, and I love being retired. I retired, too, after 25 years of working for that company. And I really like it. But I don't know what the hell I do with myself. You see, and I'm working on that. I don't have any order in my life today. I'm living with a lot of unsolved problems. But I'm loving it. And AA has been very good to me and to my family. Because you see, that kid that used to live there at the house and look at me so funny all the time, when he was 20, it turned out that part of the reason he was looking at me so funny is that he was stoned out of his gourd. Seemed like he had a problem with alcohol too, and drugs, and LSD, and all the stuff. He took it all. And I'll be damned if he didn't turn himself into AA when he was 21 years old. On May the 27th, he took a 14-year kick. Yeah, pretty nice. And my daughter's son, he's 21 years old, I guess, now, or almost. And he had 2 years of sobriety in February. And the three of us go to the greatest meeting in the world every Wednesday night, the Pacific Group, the largest group in the world. The three of us go there every Wednesday night and celebrate our sobriety. And that ain't bad. And then my daughter and my daughter-in-law both send you greetings from Al-Anon. And we're an AA family, and we weren't any kind of a family 17 and a half years ago. We're still not the best family on the block. I wouldn't try to snow anybody around AA. But we've all got the program to work if we choose to work it. And life is really pretty good. But I want to tell you something. I've had some of the worst days of my entire life sober in AA. Every now and then you hear people get up here and say, you know, my best day in... No, that's not... See, I can't say it very well. Sticks in my craw, that's why. My worst day in AA. You know, my worst day sober is better than the best day I ever had drinking. Not me. Okay, no way. Now, I had a lot of good days out there drinking. A lot of good days. And I've had some of the worst days of my entire life sober in AA. But I've had 17 and a half great years. But I've met a lot of wonderful people in AA. Jeez, I've met people from all walks of life, rich ones and poor ones and famous ones and all kinds of people. All the people that I was looking for out there in those bars, you know, I never met any of them out there. I met them all here in AA. They're all in AA here. And it's wonderful. And so life is really pretty darn good. So the only thing I can leave you folks with tonight is the wisdom, the message that I got the first time I went to a meeting. First thing that I heard in AA turned out to be true. You know, that this really is a spiritual program. And you know, I know that I found God when I walked through the doors of AA.
and it's the lights in the eyes of the people. Turn me on and keep me coming back. Thank you very much.